Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. What better way to ring in the first of spring than with the call of the northern spring peeper? Okay, that said, as much as many of us look forward to spring every year, most of us don't know much about the spring peeper, we'll learn more in a minute, or its role in the springtime ecosystem, especially the period that includes the vernal pools. Joining us now to talk about vernal pools and the plants and creatures that depend on them is David Celebrezze. He's Director of Air and Water Special Projects for the Ohio Environmental Council. Welcome back, David.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Mark Dilley, founder of wetland consulting firm Mad Scientist Associates. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. So some people might think about, why are you talking about spring and something as springy sounding as a vernal pool? But a late spring snow, or early spring snow, I should say, doesn't necessarily mark the death of the vernal pools.
Correct. In fact, some of the species, including the spring peeper, which we just heard, and that's music to my ears. Sometimes when I go out to a vernal pool, I go out a little bit too early. And so nothing is stirring except a two-legged mammal. And then by the time I hear that first spring peeper, I know that spring is not far away. But they'll come out when there's still ice over the pool. Spring peeper, the Western chorus frog, the wood frog as well. So the cold temperatures and a lot of the frogs are just kind of hanging out right now, and they're still in their burrows and under logs and things like that. Once we get those couple days of really warm weather, they'll start hopping about, and the salamanders will come out of their burrows, and they'll start crawling to the pool as well.
Well, before we fly forward too fast, what is a spring peeper?
A spring peeper is it's a frog, so it has all the characteristics of a frog. And they're only about, I think they're about an inch and a quarter in length. So they're very tiny, but their call is very loud. We just heard a couple spring peepers, and that's tolerable when you're out in a vernal pool. But if you're out in a vernal pool that has hundreds or even thousands of spring peepers, you better bring earplugs. Because I've been out there I've gone to rock concerts and everything like that. It's like a rock concert for amphibians because they keep calling, and they could be heard for about half a mile to a mile away. So when you have 1,000 of them, your ears will be ringing.
I have a good friend that lives in Canal Winchester that has a small pond outside his farmhouse, probably a good 100 feet from the house, that he calls the peeper pond. And if he calls me on a spring evening with all of his windows closed, I can hear the peepers on the phone.
So are 1,000 or so peepers typical for a vernal pool, Mark Dilley?
You'll get hundreds or thousands in a very active pool, sure.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about vernal pools this hour. If you have a question or comment about them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm talking with David Celebrezze. He's Director of Air and Water Special Projects for the Ohio Environmental Council, and also Mark Dilley. He's founder of the wetland consulting firm Mad Scientist Associates. Again, 614-292-8513. We have lots of other vernal poolish sounds coming up, so we'll be listening to those as well. But before we get started, let's talk about the vernal pool and how exactly you define it. Mark Dilley?
Well, vernal pools are areas that are also termed ephemeral ponds. They appear late in the winter, early in the spring. They persist throughout the spring months, and that's when they're active with amphibian reproduction and invertebrate life. And they then dry up later in the season so that they're more or less invisible to the untrained eye. People wouldn't necessarily recognize them later in the year. And it's the seasonal drying that makes these sites so conducive to amphibian reproduction, because most of our native amphibians require a fish-free water body in which to breed. They don't coexist with predators very effectively, so they have adapted to breed in these temporary pools where they can complete their life cycle in a short period of time with very little threat of predation from fish.
How do you tell if a body of water is a vernal pool or just a big puddle? David Celebrezzi, what's the difference?
You know, I get that question all the time at workshops that we do. You know, that tire rut in my driveway has some water. Is that a vernal pool? And the answer is always no, it is not a vernal pool. It is a wetland, so it does have certain types of soil called hydric soils that could hold water for a length of time. As Mark said, it's a fish-free environment. Mm-hmm. And certain species indicate a vernal pool here in Ohio. So species like the wood frog, the spotted salamander, things or fairy shrimp, which is a type of crustacean or macroinvertebrate, those indicate a vernal pool. And they could be as small as 8 by 8 or 6 foot by 6 foot, or they could be several acres in size. They just really vary in size, but they have that criteria of fish-free. They dry up. They have the right soils. They have the right hydrology.
And I guess, Mark Gillie, with a tire rut, that means it's likely that another tire is going to roll through there at some point and kill what's over there. So it's not very conducive to raising young fairy shrimp.
That's certainly possible. Although I have seen some tire ruts in logged areas that are functioning as vernal pools. And this was historic logging that's no longer taking place. And the animals, you know, if the hydrology is right and it's holding water during the springtime breeding period, you know, you'll see things like toads actually breeding in those pools.
Well, let's listen to a little more of the denizens of the vernal pools, the northern leopard frog. Now, is it the northern leopard frog? Because of the way it looks or the way it sounds?
To my knowledge, it does have spots on it.
Okay.
It also has a set of legs on it like you wouldn't believe.
Oh.
It can jump 5-6 feet up in the air, and part of its escape, if let's say a snake is looking to have a snack on a northern leopard frog, the northern leopard frog will jump up and then do a zigzag pattern as it jumps away. And it also, I believe it has a yellow inner thigh. And so that breaks it up. So when it jumps up, the predator will see that flash of yellow. When it lands, you don't see that flash of yellow, and it camouflages in.
It looks like maybe something's flown away.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit.
It also, the call, as you heard, is like a snore. Or if you remember that movie from the 80s, The Predator.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of reminds me of the sound the creature makes in The Predator.
So. It's sort of a weird, gross purr.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, maybe the sound. Zach in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
A big pond in our farm in Kentucky, and the peepers are absolutely outrageous when they start peeping and going. And my grandfather's actually been bit a couple times near the pond by a copperhead, and I was curious as if those frogs or those species attract certain, types of poisonous snakes or other predators that we should be worried about when we're out by the pond at night or in the early morning listening to the frogs and the wildlife.
Mark Dilley?
If you're in a region where copperheads exist, you certainly want to proceed with caution when you're in these areas because there's certainly an abundant food source at the pools that the snakes might be attracted to. Snakes will eat a goodly number of frogs, but if you are watching your step and avoid snakes when you see them, you shouldn't have any difficulty there.
Yeah. I mean, are they primarily out during the day more so, or, I mean, are we okay at night? I mean, we obviously have flashlights and stuff, but it's kind of fun to enjoy them, but at the same time, kind of scary. So
they are attracting those kind of predators, though.
If you're in a region where the snakes exist, okay. Sure, they would.
Is there a safer time of the day or night necessarily with these snakes?
Well, the snakes are probably going to be more active during the day when the sun is shining, but you'll still want to keep an eye out.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Zach.
And one quick thing with the poisonous snakes in Ohio, we have three poisonous snakes in Ohio, three species, I should say, mm-hmm. and all of them are endangered. So chances of you running into one out in a vernal pool are pretty slim. But it also brings up, you know, these are wild places, and you do need to take precautions and safety measures when you go out, so you don't injure yourself. Maybe you're going through the vernal pool and there's an underwater stump or things like that. And that's why we recommend, if you do monitor a vernal pool, go out during the day where you can kind of route your pattern for when you go out at night when it's more active.
In Ohio's Hidden Wonders, it's a guide to the animals and plants of vernal pools. It mentions that there's debate about what constitutes a vernal pool. Why the debate? Is there a debate? Or not in your mind?
I don't know that there's a huge debate, but they are a little difficult to define. There's a whole spectrum of sort of classes of vernal pools, and they behave differently and they support different fauna. So they're a little more difficult to pin down.
Okay. And what's the distinction between wetlands and vernal pools? Did we make that? Is it subtle, or is it the wetlands are there most of the time?
Wetlands are kind of like an umbrella term. And so a vernal pool is a type of wetland, just like a bog or a fen is a type of wetland.
Okay. All right. And does the definition of a vernal pool and the indicators of a vernal pool, does it vary with location? For instance, what Zach was talking about, they're going to have the copperheads attracted to it in one part of the country, and that is not the case in others. I mean, does it differ?
Certainly there are, depending on what species you're looking at and what part of the state, like for instance, blue-spotted salamanders are found in extreme northwest part of Ohio. So if you have blue-spotted salamanders up there, you have a vernal pool, most likely. Here in central Ohio, some of the indicator species would be like the fairy shrimp, the spotted salamander, the wood frog, or even the marbled salamander.
I'm going to bet that we don't have any sound of a fairy shrimp.
Yeah, it's a fairy shrimp.
They seem kind of quiet.
Yeah, and salamanders.
David, do your best fairy shrimp impression.
Right.
There it is. Did you hear it?
So what is a fairy shrimp, and is it something you can actually see?
It is something you can actually see. It's a crustacean. It gets to be about inch and a quarter in length. There are different species of fairy shrimp. They have a number of legs. They kind of have an alien-looking head, and they swim upside down. And they are when they first hatch, they have antenna, and that's what they use to propel themselves through the water. As their legs develop, they use their legs.
And they only can survive in a vernal pool because there are no predators.
They're adapted to life in the vernal pool, and they have a very unique life cycle that allows them to persist in those areas even when they're dry 9 or 10 months of the year.
Well, let's listen to another denizen of the vernal pool, the western chorus frog. Before we hear that, though, David Celebrezzi, why don't you tell us about it?
Oh, good. I thought you were going to ask me to do the call, and I only do a certain number of calls, and that's not one of them. The western chorus frog is a type of tree frog here in Ohio. I believe it's the second smallest tree frog. It comes out pretty early, too. It could be found in the same vernal pools as spring peepers. They have three stripes down their back, and this is the time of year that they are active. And sometimes it's hard to distinguish a western chorus frog from a spring peeper by appearance. A spring peeper has kind of an X on the back, whereas the western chorus frog has those three stripes on the back. But they certainly can be found in the same vernal pool.
Okay, here's the western chorus frog. We'll be right back with a show about vernal pools when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
AM It's 47 degrees in downtown Columbus. Thanks for joining us. We'll warm up to a high in the mid-50s today. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 30. Some more sunshine and a nice day with a high of 60 on Saturday. There is a chance of rain Sunday, but a high of 65. Support comes from the Wellington School, where fearless learning is celebrated in preschool through grade 12. The Wellington School will host an information session for prospective parents on Wednesday, April 10th at 9 a.m. More at wellington.org. And support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, presenting Piano Men, the music of Billy Joel, Elton John, and Stevie Wonder, featuring guests Chester Gregory and Dave Powers. It's Thursday, April 11th through Sunday the 14th at the Southern Theater. Details and tickets at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about vernal pools, the temporary but vibrant habitats that show up every spring and are home to creatures like the gray tree frog. Still with us is David Celebrezzi, Director of Air and Water Special Projects for the Ohio Environmental Council. David, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And Mark Dilley, he's founder of wetland consulting firm Mad Scientist Associates. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you.
And joining us now by phone from West Virginia is Mick Mikashan. He is a wetland ecologist with the Midwest Biodiversity Institute. Welcome, Mick.
Hi, Ann. Glad to join you.
So what can you tell us about the gray tree frog?
The gray tree frog is one of our later breeders compared to the frogs we've been talking about. It doesn't actually start doing its breeding behavior until late April or early May. And once they get to the pools, there's already a lot of things that have happened in the pools, but they get it going a little bit later, and they develop a little bit later and come out of the pools a little bit later. They are the ones that, if you've looked at the tadpoles, The gray tree frogs have the very red tinge to their tail, which makes their tadpoles really easy to identify. And these are the tree frogs. They're bigger than the peepers. You know, they're more like 2-3 inches in length. And these are the ones that have the ability to somewhat change their skin color depending on the background that they're occupying.
If you have a question or comment for our guests, we're talking about vernal pools. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rod in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Rod.
Yes, good morning. Incidentally, I found some wetlands that might qualify as vernal pools along railroad tracks, where there's depressions and the water collects over the winter. My question is, are there differences between various types of vernal pools, for example, those you might find in woodlands as opposed to meadows?
Absolutely, there are differences. The dynamic, the nutrient inputs to those systems differ. The available adjacent habitat affects the fauna that will utilize the pool. In Ohio, typically when we talk about vernal pools, we think about forested vernal pools. If you go across the country to California, vernal pool is something much different to the average Californian. They're more open, marshy type pools. But we're talking about the same hydrologic dynamic, that these are sites that, you know, flood in the spring and dry out later in the year. And you would definitely see different fauna, a different vernal pool in that setting versus further back into a woodland.
Thank you, Rod, for that question. Mick Mikashan, we're talking about vernal pools as if they're around every corner, in every forest, in every meadow, but it's actually a very vulnerable ecosystem, and we're losing them.
We are. And the thing with the vernal pools is, you know, not only the pool's important, the surrounding land use to the pools is so critical to supporting the biology that's in the pools. For instance, to be able to have salamanders breeding in a pool, you've got to have the pool itself, and then, you know, probably on the neighborhood of about 40 acres surrounding the pool, of which a large percentage is forested in order to support those populations. And then if you talk about something like the wood frog, which is much further ranging, you're looking at, 600, maybe 700 acres, of which a large part is forested. So it's not just the pools, but it's what goes on around the pools and what that habitat is. Most of the pond breeding amphibians are adapted to a forested landscape. Ohio was, traditionally 95% forested. So when we lose that, we can still retain the pool, but it loses functionality.
So what's lost when we lose a vernal pool?
Well, we lose this really unique biodiversity that's associated with them. Certainly there's aesthetic things that go with that. There's also, kind of this loss of our natural history and our link to the land. We also, they do some pretty good things in the watershed from a ecosystem services standpoint. One thing that these vernal pools do an outstanding job of is holding flood water. And because they're just depressions on the landscape, they fill up with water, and then they, through evaporation and transpiration, they empty. But then they can fill up again several times, and they collectively, these pools can hold a lot of water. And it's all storm water that never gets into our stream systems, and it really reduces flooding problems in watersheds that have an intact population of vernal pools.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Mark Dilley, did you?
I was going to add that these sorts of wetlands contribute recharge to the groundwater, which actually helps to maintain base flows in our rivers and streams and actually results in a healthier watershed overall.
I live near the big park along, it's the only Olentangy parklands in Worthington, and they're starting to naturalize some of the areas around there, not just right along the river, but inside the park, particularly in Worthington. And there are big pools in the spring. I know my dog plays in them, sorry to say. But it gets mowed, a lot of it gets mowed over every year, at least once or twice a year. They do it to develop these naturalized areas. They want things to reseed properly. What does that matter if it's being mowed over a couple times a year when it comes to propagation of these species in the vernal pool? Go ahead.
It does make a difference.
Okay.
It does make a difference. And, some of it depends on, what your species of interest. But some of these amphibians, and I guess that's primarily what we're talking about today, don't migrate very far to get to their breeding pools. And so it depends on the species. But, if you're mowing an area that's, pretty wide around that pool, say, greater than 200 meters or something like that, then you're going to be limiting on what can utilize the pool for breeding, because a lot of these species will consider a mowed area a pretty hostile habitat to to go across to get to the pools to breed. And, that can be very limiting. They're adapted to a forested landscape. They like to have a canopy over top of them, and they like to have leaf litter and other things that keep the environment moist when they travel back and forth. And of course, a lot of times to add to the moistness, they do these migrations when it's raining. But yeah, the surrounding land use is critical to the life of a vernal pool.
David Celebrezzi?
And I'll just throw in there that the salamander species that utilize the vernal pools, they have a high fidelity to the pool that they crawled out of. So if you destroy or you impact a local pool, chances are you're having a negative impact on that those species, because they're not just going to, in the springtime come out, see, oh, my vernal pool is now a housing development. I'm going to go, hitchhike to another vernal pool. We've heard from people that they've had salamanders or frogs show up on their doorstep, literally, and say, what do I do? And I usually ask them, well, do you know what was on the land before? They're like, I think it was some type of wetland. Well, that's the breeding site now, and so you're going to lose that local population. And of course, salamanders and frogs are voracious eaters of mosquitoes as well. So when you destroy, when you get rid of the predators,
and I read somewhere in preparing for this that mosquitoes are very important to vernal pools, and if we try to eradicate them or when we're trying to get rid of them, that's a problem too, right, Mark Dilley?
That's correct. They are an important food, an important food source in within the vernal pools. But there's a campaign that's sort of been launched called "Healthy Wetlands Don't Bite" that calls attention to the fact that if you allow for a natural balance within the system, if you have enough protected buffer and you provide habitats for would-be mosquito predators, that the wetlands do not tend to produce a lot of nuisance mosquitoes.
If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there, as did some jokers making fun of the fairy shrimp. So if you want to check out our Facebook page and the jokes, it's nothing to joke about, by the way. Very important species. Go to our Facebook page and check it out. We have an email from Kathy in Alexandria, Ohio. We have vernal pools with tons of leopard frogs. The problem is we also have a saltwater swimming pool close to the woods, which they love. I have frog logs, but they still can't seem to get out. I fish them out each morning, but I do have some fatalities, which I can't bear. How do I discourage or keep them from getting into the pool? You know, saltwater pools are becoming more popular now. Any thoughts about that?
I don't know if maybe putting a cover over it. I know it might be a little bit labor intensive to do that every day, but that would definitely keep them out of there. And of course, saltwater would kill them if they get in there and swimming around for a while.
For too long. Okay, Kathy. Kathy, I hope that helps. When I hear about the destruction of the wetlands in Ohio, just 10% is left of, I think you mentioned there was 5 million acres that Ohio had a few hundred years ago. It kind of makes me think of the rainforest in South America a little bit. It's disappearing that fast now, right? Are there protections, though, correct?
Absolutely.
Mark?
Yes, the rate of decline has dropped considerably because of the regulations and rules that are in place. The wetland resource is better protected now than it has been in the past, and a lot of the massive loss in our state, we've lost about 90% of our wetlands, has occurred as a result of agriculture, converting lands to grow crops and draining those lands by artificial means. So the wetlands that remain are particularly precious resources and worthy of protection.
And also, like, to create a wetland, it's not just digging a hole in the ground anywhere. You have to look to see where there was a wetland before and do a do restoration. So with those wetlands that are here, they do need to be protected, and the regulations in place do provide a layer of protection. We encourage people to explore the wetlands and get a baseline of data out there, which could be translated into greater protections.
Because you need to look for those hydric soils again. It's not what's on top is as important at the outset as what's underneath.
If you're creating a
right.
wetland, you really do. You're restoring a wetland. I should say you do need to look at the soils. It's very important.
One thing that about the regulatory program is that it only protects the from anything that's within the wetland boundary. And so when you have critical surrounding land uses that need to be intact to protect those wetlands, then those surrounding areas can get developed, and they don't even fall under a need for a permit. So the wetlands can get degraded even though there's no direct impact to them.
I was going to add, too, that of our wetlands in Ohio, vernal pools are really probably the most vulnerable class of wetlands because of the fact that they're dry for a good period of the year every year and may go unnoticed. To the untrained eye, they may not look much different than the surrounding forest, and yet they're there every spring. So those tend to fall through the cracks. They get missed.
So you have a wetland consulting firm, Mark Dilley. Is this something that you're trained to look for?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's clues that nature will provide that tell you whether a pool is in an area. David has some really nice photos in this Ohio's Hidden Wonders book that will show the seasonal changes from the same camera angle of a vernal pool. And you can see how distinctly different that area looks throughout the seasons. And that's, we're trained to look at the plants and evidence of hydrology to figure out if those pools are there. But oftentimes they go unnoticed and development may press on without any awareness that there's a pool there if they happen to look at it late in the year and don't know what visual evidence is there.
Wallace in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome, Wallace.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you. I always enjoy your programs. A question I have is the following. We just recently moved from Dublin to Delaware. I used to have my regular beat up at Glacier Ridge, but now I'm quite interested, considering with the forthcoming spring weather, of asking the gentleman if there are identifiable vernal pools up in the Delaware Dam Reservoir area.
Any thoughts? Yeah,
yes, there are. There are.
Mick?
And, yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are some vernal pools up in that area. I've monitored a few in the past that are in the wildlife area that adjoins the reservoir. So there definitely are. And this is a time of the year where, the frogs will help you out in trying to find those.
Right. And when you say the wildlife area, you're talking about the state park?
No, the Division of Wildlife, state wildlife area.
Okay. And there's also, that brings up how people can get, boots in the, or waders in the water, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And that is, check with your local metro parks. The Franklin County Metro Parks has a great program where they usually have hikes going out to vernal pools. There's groups like Stratford Ecological Center. They have a couple vernal pool tours. And it is a balance because on the one hand, you want to educate folks, but on the other hand, you don't want to have 100 people out in a vernal pool stomping around. And that's something with our program. We encourage people to, look at every single inch of the vernal pool. You know, you could take samples here and there and photo documentation.
But the rule is don't take anything living from.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's their home. They're providing a service to us. We're only visitors. We leave only footsteps, take only photos, right?
Yeah, I remember collecting tadpoles, and I'm thinking about all the damage I did. and then also, there someone wrote in yesterday in anticipation of the show and said, my daughter's 7th grade class at Graham Expeditionary Middle School is visiting vernal pools on Thursday. They said the Ohio Environmental Council is raising money for a vernal pools iPhone app to keep better tabs on local pool life cycles. When we return and continue our conversation, we'll talk about that. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The president, to express solidarity with federal workers suffering under the sequester, announced he's giving up 5% of his pay. That means he, like every postal worker or park ranger, will have to get by on $380,000 a year, plus free housing, a jumbo jet, and a band that plays whenever he enters the room. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the Bare Bones News Quiz from NPR.
Wait, don't tell me. Tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And thanks for joining us. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend begins with a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. 47 degrees with sunshine, highs in the mid-50s today, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 30, and some sunshine with a high of 60 on Saturday. Support comes from Ohio Northern University, investing in the success of its students by offering more than $58 million in scholarships and financial aid each year. ONU offers nationally ranked academics and a 92% job placement rate. Junior Explore ONU Day is April 20th. Details at onu.edu. And support for All Sides comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, which presents a new play called Apotheosis, a fantasy based on the life and work of Edgar Allan Poe. Performances take place now through April 14th at Ohio State's Roy Bowen Theater. More information is available at theater.osu.edu. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. This hour, we've been talking about the life of vernal pools. Still with us, David Celebrezze, Director of Air and Water Special Projects for the Ohio Environmental Council. David, thanks a lot for joining us again today. And Mark Dilley, he's a founder of the wetland consulting firm Mad Scientist Associates. Mark, thanks again for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Also by phone, Mick Mikashan, he's a wetland ecologist with the Midwest Biodiversity Institute. Mick, once again, thanks for joining us. And joining us now is the green frog. That sounds like he's like strumming something.
They do sound like they're playing a banjo. Whenever I hear a green frog, I always think of a frog sitting in a rocking chair with iced tea playing a banjo somewhere.
So we have an email from Sue, and she says, please explain the life cycles of these frogs. When do they enter and leave the vernal pool and lay eggs? And, of course, not just the green frog. She's not referring to that. She's referring to all the frogs. How many different species, Mikashan, are there in, you know, a good vernal pool?
Well, you could easily have, let's see, probably four or five different species. And then, you know, it varies across the regions of the state. And they all have a little bit different, reproduction cycle. We're talking about the spring peepers and the western chorus frogs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they start really early, and, you know, they're mating and laying eggs now. And leopard frogs are in the pools now mating. Gray tree frogs are going to be a little bit later. Actually, we get some frogs that are casual users of vernal pools, like the green frog. Sometimes we get those using vernal pools, although that's not their preferred habitat. Same with occasionally you can get a bullfrog, especially if you have more of an open canopy. And those individuals, those species don't lay their eggs until early May. So there's a lot of different timing going on with the reproduction happening in the pools. The earlier breeding ones get in there and they lay their eggs, their larvae start developing, and, you know, it's a race against the clock to get out of there before the pool dries up. And,
I was going to ask you, to what extent does the health of the pool and all of the species that thrive on it depend on dry weather too? I mean, is dry weather an important part of it? In other words, if a vernal pool, Mark Dilley, was wet year round, would it be the same thing?
It wouldn't. Things would definitely change, and there are concerns with climate change, you know, how that's going to affect the hydrology of pools and how these different species fare over time. I know that with things like the green frog, their life cycle in the pool takes a little longer to complete. Bullfrogs may remain in tadpole form for a couple years in Ohio before they mature as an adult frog. And the breeding in these pools is sort of a gambler's game, particularly if you're one of those species that require a little more time to mature. I've come upon pools that have dried before green frogs have hatched out and found, you know, just layers of dead green frog tadpoles because they didn't manage to metamorphose before the pool dried up.
And some species, especially when you get to the salamanders, they have some internal way of knowing when the pool is drying up, and that will they'll metamorph or become those young adults quicker.
And move on.
But if the water's in there for a good length of time, they'll hang out in the pool because the salamander larvae are one of the top predators in the pool. Whereas once they leave that pool, they're almost on the bottom of the food chain again.
Mick, does climate change have anything to do with the shrinking numbers of vernal pools that we know of?
I don't think the shrinking numbers, no.
Okay.
I think
development's the big killer.
Development, yeah, and but maybe the productivity of the pools has possibly been affected, you know, in various years depending on what we see in the weather. Yeah.
Jeff in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A couple of things. Number one is a comment. We have a little flower farm. We're located in Delaware County, and our property is adjacent to Delaware State Park, the wildlife area. And the spring peepers came out last week. I think it was around the 11th of March. It was our first warm day. And perhaps 10 minutes or so ago, you had a call from a gentleman who had recently moved to Delaware, mm-hmm. and he was asking if there were vernal ponds out at Delaware State Park in the wildlife area. There certainly are. If he comes onto the east side of the park following Horseshoe Road and turns in at the levee, which I believe is Leonardsburg Road, and parks, there's plenty of places for the public to park their car and gets out. There are probably 8 or 9 vernal ponds or pools right up along that area on the east side of the state park.
But people should be very careful.
Then the number one thing is get, especially if it's on private property, get permission.
Okay. It's a state park.
Right.
And when you do go out there, just be cognizant of, you know, we do have an impact, mm-hmm. and just to try to minimize that impact when you go out. And you could do that through a number of different ways. Like I mentioned before, going out during the day, not taking anything from the vernal pool. If you do handle the amphibian species, make sure your hands are wet and make sure you don't put on any of the antibacterial soap. Make sure you don't use any hand lotion and don't use any off or bug repellent, because when you go out into a vernal pool, if you have that on, it's going to leak into the vernal pool in the water, and that's going to cause the death of some of the macroinvertebrates and even some of the amphibian species.
Sunscreen?
I would probably not wear sunscreen either. Long sleeve shirt, a hat. If you go out at night, obviously sunscreen won't be a problem. But
okay. Jeff, you said you had something else?
No, those were the two things.
Yep, All right.
I've already heard the peepers out here. Okay. So they're there, and that was great advice about the going to the pond. Certainly don't take anything in that's going to harm them. But it is a state park, it's public, and it's just a wonderful area to view wildlife there.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks for your call.
Thank you for taking it. Take care. Bye.
Take care. I wanted to talk about, how else people can help to preserve them. But first of all, I wanted to also get to the mobile app that the Ohio Environmental Council is developing. You're doing a fundraiser for that?
Yes, it's be the first one in Ohio. We're raising funds to develop a smartphone app for monitoring. Right now, we have monitoring forms, the paper kind. So you print out those forms and you go into the vernal pool. If you have a GPS, you bring your GPS unit, all these different tools that you have. And so what the app does is combine a lot of these tools right on your phone. It would be the first, as I mentioned, the first one in Ohio. We're doing a 2-month campaign to raise funds for it. People could go to WOSU's website and find our website on there for more information. But one thing it'll do is, let's say we're in Franklin County and you're using it, it'll pull up the amphibian species that are only known to exist here in Franklin County. Once that data is collected, at the end of the monitoring night, the user hits submit. That information is emailed to them, and it's also emailed to us. And what we do is we store that data. We have an online database. We don't give out the exact location of the pool, property owner, or observer information, but it's a way to get a baseline of information of what's in these vernal pools. And if you monitor them over time, you could see trends of, are they improving? Are they staying the same? Or are they being impacted? If they are being impacted, then we'll help identify what's impacting them and try to mitigate that, which also raises the question about the state's regulations. If somebody is impacting a wetland, they have to get a permit to do that. And the Ohio EPA, they're the agency that handles that. And they usually have a public comment period. So we always encourage people to be aware. You can contact the Ohio EPA to get put on the list to be notified of any potential wetland impacts in your area and to comment on those.
So if you want to learn more about that vernal pool mobile app that's in development, I guess, we're still raising funds for it. You can go to the oec.org/vernal pool app. We'll have that link on our website at wosu.org/all sides. Bonnie called in. She said, when the spring peepers and other animals show up in the pools in the spring, such as what Jeff described, how do they handle the below freezing temperatures that are so common in Ohio springs, like today, I'll add? What happens, Mark Dilley?
They just find cover and curl up and rest until
they don't die then.
No. They'll just crawl into a rotten log or under some leaves, just seek cover for a period of time, and when it warms up again, they'll resume their activity.
And something interesting about the wood frog is that it actually freezes over winter. So ice crystals will form in between its cells, and that's one reason why as soon as it gets warm, or we have a couple warm days, it'll thaw out. It'll do some self-healing, because it's never a real good thing on the body when you have ice crystals form inside, and then it'll hop on out to the
pool.
It's
like cryogenics or something.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Okay, so I read on an EPA site, and this was an U.S. EPA, so it might not apply to Ohio, but that wildflowers often bloom in circles of color that follow the receding shoreline of the pools. Mikashan, do you know about that and why that is?
Well, I think it's kind of corresponds to the change in the saturation of the soils in those areas. And I think that the plants are blooming as the conditions become right for them. And so as the pool recedes, then you're seeing a whole progression of wildflowers getting the right conditions, not only just where their position is on the pool, but also the right amount of daylight, the right temperatures, and those types of things happening.
And vernal pools provide habitat for many rare plants and animals that are able to withstand very harsh conditions. And it made me wonder when I was reading about that if that's the case, why can't they survive less harsh conditions? We talked a little bit about that with climate change, but climate change doesn't always denote less harsh or more harsh. It just kind of depends. But why can't they survive in a place where it doesn't get cold as much? Is this an idiotic question?
Well, I think, why
can't they adapt, I guess?
Well, I think they have adapted. It's taken thousands or millions of years for them to find their ecological niche. And so, like with the wood frog, for example, mm-hmm. It comes out very early. It's a top predator of a vernal pool. And I think they've just adapted to that, the ecosystem, over time. When you have habitat fragmentation, which happens very rapidly, they can't adapt to that quick change, given they've had, millions of years to develop and to adjust to the habitats that are vernal pools.
We have just a few minutes left. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a quick call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Very quickly, faster yet, Facebook page, if you want, and if you want to go and read that funny joke about the poor fairy shrimp, you can do that too.
The fairy shrimp never get any respect, but a little monitoring tip is if you're in a vernal pool at nighttime, shine a flashlight down into the water and wait a minute, and the fairy shrimp are actually drawn to the light. It's pretty fascinating. They just kind of appear out of nowhere, and that's kind of how they got their name. Is they appear in these wooded vernal pools out of nowhere, kind of like fairies do. And I'll just throw out, we do have a vernal pool webinar April 5th.
Oh, okay.
That we're going to be talking about a general overview about vernal pools. Folks could go to our website to sign up for that. And then also, I've started Twittering, and I think we're following you all on the Twitter, and it's Vernal Pool Guy. And we usually have some interesting information and interesting tidbits, facts, and upcoming events.
Mick Migashon, before we let you go, you know, we were talking earlier about what's left in Ohio, which isn't much compared to what it had a couple hundred years ago. What about nationally? Are there any states in the country that have, is it the less developed states perhaps that are doing okay and are sort of bastions for the vernal pools now?
There are some areas that have much more than others. And, you know, some of it just depends on what the history of the state has been and, you know, what's been the prime movers of their economy. And, you know, in states where it's a lot of times where, you know, tourist ecotourism is you know, a plus, then they've got, you know, they've preserved more of their natural habitat and they're going to do a little better on the vernal pools along with a lot of other, you know, aspects of their landscape.
Sometimes when I think of West Virginia, I think less developed, but of course there is the all the mining that's occurred in West Virginia, and that's probably had a big impact on it.
That has. It's, there's no doubt about it. And again, you know, there is a certain level of water quality that's needed in the vernal pools, and acid mine drainage impacts can affect vernal pool water as well as streams.
And I'll just
David Celebrezzi, sure.
It not only takes citizens to keep eyes and ears open for vernal pools and to monitor their health, it takes many organizations as well to provide that support. I know here in Central Ohio, the Columbus Foundation and the Columbus Zoo have been great partners of ours in reaching out to students, to teachers, to citizens here in Central Ohio on taking folks out to vernal pools, to holding workshops and things of that nature. So I think that also plays a key role in whatever state you're in, is if you have foundations that make it a priority, you're going to have greater protections and more public involvement.
Well, David Celebrezzi, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it. Hopefully next time we talk about vernal pools, there'll be more of them.
I hear you.
David Celebrezzi, he's Director of Air and Water Special Projects for the Ohio Environmental Council. Mick Migashon, thank you so much for joining us from West Virginia.
My pleasure.
Mick is a wetland ecologist with the Midwest Biodiversity Institute. And Mark Dilley, thank you as well for joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Mark Dilley, he's founder of the wetland consulting firm Mad Scientist Associates. You can get that link for the Vernal Pool mobile app at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.